Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Food USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hi, everybody. You're tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. The show is Flash Talks Cash. We're about money, making it, spending it, saving it, what to do with it when you get it. I'm your host, Joanne Flash Fleming, with my co-host, Andrew My Son Newman.
Good afternoon.
Hi. And we have our beloved engineers, Jack Inslee and the famous Carlos.
Yeah, Carlos.
Our show is on every week from 4:30 to 5 on Thursdays. We broadcast live. And if you can't listen while we're streaming live, all the shows are archived on the webpage, or you can download a free podcast from iTunes.
The website. I know you're a little old, but we call them sites nowadays,
website.
Not pages.
Oh, he just loves to pick on me. While we're streaming, you can call us or email us. The phone number is
718-497-2128.
497-2128.
That's what I said.
We'd like to hear from you. And today's show is Occupy Wall Street Continues. We have a wonderful guest today. We have Professor Julian Brash. Okay, give me time.
Well, it's better than last week. You couldn't get the guy's name
was really hard. Say hi, Julian.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
Okay. He's friend of Jeff Maskowski. Maskowski. That
you
was
have a hard
mouthful.
Time with it as well, huh?
It's not an easy way to go. So, Jeff. See, now you got me confused. Professor Julian Brash is visiting us all the way from New Jersey. In beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn, from Montclair State University. He teaches anthropology and urban studies, right?
That's right.
Okay. Before we get started, well, let's find out a little bit about Julian. He's a professor out there, and he recently wrote a book about one of our favorite characters these days is Mayor Bloomberg. And his book is, tell me,
Jesus, Joanne.
Bloomberg's
New York, Class and Governance in New York City, published by University of Georgia Press.
Okay. So it's available online?
Online, from the press website. Just Google it and you'll find it.
Do you like Bloomberg in the book?
I come out somewhat critical of Bloomberg. I try to be fair and look at how his corporate approach to governance kind of works and doesn't work,
okay,
and then what it does in terms of politics and inequality and so on in the city.
Okay, so he does do some good stuff in the book.
There are some things that he's
done
that
well,
I think are okay.
Right.
Yeah.
He does things not so well some other times.
Yes.
Okay, so read the book and tell us what you think about Mayor Bloomberg after you read Julian's book. Today we're going to talk about the occupation some more. We're going to, of course, Bloomberg's going to come up. And we're going to, as many of you know, or some of you may know, I am now volunteering down there doing some accounting work, so I have an inside look at some of the aspects of Occupy, and it's going along well. It's very successful, and but you know, we left off last week talking about what was going to happen with the cleanup. That was last Thursday. The cleanup was scheduled to happen Friday morning, and we all know that the city backed off. I have one question for Julian, and tell me, because you know how New York City politics work, because you understand Bloomberg, and he called it off.
He didn't call it off.
Yeah, he did.
I thought it was the owners of the property that called it off.
Well,
they said,
tell us what happened on that side of the fence.
Right. Well, I think it was the owners of the property in league with the city had proposed it to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I think that together they decided not to do it. I think the owners of the property were more concerned, or were really being pushed by the Bloomberg administration, first to do the cleanup, and then I think over the week as the reaction came, and as, you know, thousands of people showed up,
that's
and
right.
union members showed up, mm-hmm. and, you know, everyone from all over the world was watching, I think they got a sense that this was probably not a fight worth having, and so they backed off. I think it was basically a matter of, you know, kind of calculation and PR.
Yeah.
They realized that this would not look good and that people were not going to leave without, you know, a fair amount of resistance. So
Did you also hear that Bloomberg's lady friend is actually on the board of directors of, who's the owner of the
Brookfield
Properties? Brookfield Properties.
Right.
She's on the board of directors. So there is a little
conflict.
Yeah.
It's a little.
Well, a lot of New York City kind of elite private institutions, and then the Bloomberg administration, because he has a lot of people from the private sector in his administration. There's a lot of linkages there, and there always has been, but I think it's pretty intense in the Bloomberg administration because he pulls so much from the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you looked around, you find those kinds of relationships in lots of places. But in this one, obviously, it's pretty...
More.
It looks a little blatant,
yeah.
because of the stakes of you know, what's
so,
at stake.
So when they blinked and they turned their back, they decided to not come in and clean up. The occupiers say that it's because they had so much representation. Just like you said, the union members showed up, and there was like 5,000 or 7,000 people in the park ready to deal with the city. Do you think that the occupiers won that battle because of that? Are they ahead on this one?
I think they are, and I think that what's so kind of interesting and hopeful about the whole movement is that it's got elites really kind of back on their heels. And this whole episode, you know, in the space of 4 or 5 days, that, you know, Bloomberg was quite emphatic that people had to get out. And this was just a sensible, common sense thing. You have to wash the park.
Well, that's the way he approaches.
Right.
He's very pragmatic.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. And so I think that. But the fact that so quickly it turned around, and then on, you know, Saturday, he was being kind of mocked on Saturday Night Live.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea that you mm-hmm. would wash the park. I mean, they said, you know, the idea that New York is constantly being power washed is obviously, you know, kind of ridiculous. So I think, but the fact that someone like Bloomberg, who, you know, is very confident and very assertive and often very confrontational, would back off and would seem kind of caught, you know, off guard like that, shows how I think a lot of, you know, political and economic elites are really kind of, you know, worried about what's happening, because it is, you know, it's managed to stick around in New York.
Catching
and obviously
on.
It's
right.
caught on
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, everywhere from, you know, Taipei to,
right.
you know, Topeka, Kansas.
Right.
There's Occupy this. Now they're going to be Occupy museums. I mean, the whole thing is really catching on in a way that I think has elites really worried.
So let's talk about, that was Friday. So then Saturday was Occupy Worldwide, and it went on around the world. And it was a huge success, except for, and this is only my own personal opinion, except for the violence that went on in Rome and I think in London. Now, London has had a history this year of violent protest march, starting with the tuition hike. But I didn't know that, you know, that it was, I was surprised why how it was going on in Europe. It was a lot more violent than it was, say, in America and the rest of the world. But America's been very peaceful, mm-hmm. Unusually peaceful, as far as I could
well,
see.
Well, I think a lot of Europe has been very violent lately, with even in Greece and Rome have both had very tumultuous political situations, where this thrown on top of it is only going to incite more people to get into these small and closed places where they're already upset and using violence. And even in England, where I think some students were killed or something like that, which sparked violence a few months ago. And to add this fuel to that fire, I think, is what really pushed it to that brink. And they weren't actually taking the themes and ideas of what we're doing here in our Occupies.
Yeah.
You know, Occupy Wall Street is becoming somewhat of a franchise now. So my concern is, should we be worried that it could get violent, say in New York? Let's talk about New York, because you know more about the politics of New York than the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think that the way the movement has been able to kind of spread and sustain its ideas is pretty impressive. I think they have a strong organizational form. From the outside looking in, they look very smart and careful about what they do. And I think the violence in Europe comes out of the fact that, you know, European politics, I mean, there's a much stronger sort of and long kind of ongoing tradition of, you know, protest and resistance in Europe. There's stronger unions. There's a stronger left. And, you know, so people are in the streets more often and people are used to being more confrontational. I think the U.S., despite the fact that we think of ourselves as, you know, sort of, you know, very, you know, we
cowboys.
Yes, exactly. I think violence. Politically, the U.S. is actually a pretty passive country. Yeah. And so even the fact that this is going on, that people are getting out in the streets on a regular basis is a pretty, you know, amazing thing to be happening in the U.S., which, as I said,
so you don't you don't see Bloomberg getting pissed off at one point and setting out the riot police.
I think that would be the only way the violence would be incited.
No,
is if the police are put to force on the individuals. I don't think the individuals are going to come out as violent, especially but 4 or 5 weeks in at this point. There hasn't been any real serious outbreaks of violence like there are in these European places where there are instances of violence prior to the protests that we're doing now with the Occupy. Like Greece has been having violent riots because of labor and other things, and then Rome or Italy had the president was also almost impeached about last week, so this is just fuel to that fire. And then England has their history recently, so I think it's a different situation that we're getting into here than those countries are in at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, if you know, the issue of what's going to happen in terms of, you know, how Bloomberg and how other elites react to this, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, at this point, it seems like Bloomberg has clearly calculated that it would be worse for that it would probably generate more sympathy if there was kind of a violent sweep through the park and people were removed. You know, if things continue going as they're going and there are people being turned out, you know, by the thousands every week, then you don't know. And if it continues and it seems like it actually might be threatening, you know, the sort of current arrangements of power and money that exist, you never know how people will react. So, I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but I would say, you know, given the history of the way, you know, elites react when challenged, it's certainly possible that there'd be, you know, that could get ugly
but
at some point.
How would that violence be incited, Michael, other than the police?
Right.
That's the way I see it. The riot police coming out. Rubber bullets and tear gas.
But there hasn't been anything to incite that kind of response.
Not yet. But it's only been 4 or 5 weeks.
But when have you ever seen an instance of protest or sit-in or wherever that has gone on in this form for this long? Has there been in history?
Well, in Kent State back, it wasn't supposed to be a violent end, but it was a peaceful protest, which protests were happening regularly back in those days.
No, I understand, but how long were those protests going on, and how organized and how far-reaching as this organization and this protest is? I feel like I've never heard of anything in history of our country or in the world where it's a process has gone on this long.
The occupation.
Yes, how it's been this long and this organized and this nonviolent, except for a few instances, of course.
Right.
But, like, is there a history of something like this happening before?
I mean, I think if you look at the civil rights movement, I mean, it was sustained over, you know, over a decade, you know, a fairly, you know, constant stream of different forms of action, political action, political resistance. I mean, I think the thing that would probably happen is if there is, I mean, it's hard to know at this point if they would just kind of, you know, send police in to clear out the park or, you know, to break up a demonstration violently. I think that one of the reasons I think that the people at Occupy Wall Street are so concerned about this is that obviously if someone in the protest did something that could serve as a pretext for that,
exactly,
you know, I'm sure someone, you know, Bloomberg or the commissioner, the police commissioner, whoever could step through that, you know, open
use that
door
as an excuse,
loophole.
But that has happened, frankly. You know, the day after the morning of the cleanup, when they were given the reprieve,
they did
a march down to Wall Street, and there was a couple of jerks that went ahead and got themselves arrested, but they were disconnected from the rest of the people. They said, those are jerks.
But
there's always jerks. You know, out of a million people, you have some jerks.
You use that one niche to get in, and then all of a sudden you just blow the whole thing
open.
And also, I mean, there's an issue of there are people in the movement. There are different ideas about how you position yourself vis-a-vis the law. I mean, some people think that it needs to be a legal, you know, protest, and therefore you do basically, you work within the parameters that the police or the city tell you. There are other people who think that in order to get things to happen, you have to kind of step outside what's legal. And so I know there's been a lot of tension between
people,
you know, just over whether you're not going to walk on whether you're going to walk on the sidewalk or not, which is a small instance. But I think that's a real, you know, it's a legitimate question, because obviously, you know, every social movement in the U.S. that's gotten anything accomplished has had more and less confrontational and radical wings. I mean, you know, the civil rights movement, you had the Black Panthers, and then you had the mainline civil rights movement. Same with the labor movement. And so something similar is happening here. And, you know, how that works out is, you know, remains to be seen. And it's a kind of a tension within the movement, but probably a productive one, because it's probably best to have both. Because one helps make the other one, you know, seem more reasonable.
Other. They feed each other.
That's what happened. The violence or the pepper spray or whatever it is, the arresting that is incited by some of the farther radical people is what got a lot of the news and media attention, which actually made this movement grow. Whereas before, it was just a bunch of people sitting in a park and no one really paid attention. And then once they started, because no, as we spoke about when we first started our view on this, is just no one was reporting it. Yahoo was blocking emails. Right. And it wasn't on any
Flash
news
Fleming
service.
Was reporting it.
Flash Talks Cash was reporting it. You were on the front line, and we appreciate you getting out there.
There you go.
It's these radicals who actually bring some of this media attention that garner more sympathy for the movement. But you need a certain fine line, and how do you find that balance is the question.
Okay, let's come back to that. Let's take a minute now, and we'll come back and talk some more about the violence and the rebels. Okay, we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Flash Talks Cash. We're talking today to Professor Julian Brash. He is from Montclair State University. We're talking about, of course, the occupation down on Wall Street. Julian has put out a book recently about Mayor Bloomberg, and he seems to know a lot about the guy, good and bad. Frankly, I have mixed feelings about Bloomberg myself. His book is Bloomberg's New York, Class and Governance in the Luxury City.
Can I ask you a question? Did you interview Bloomberg for the book, or...
No, I did not. I tried. I got the highest up I got in the administration was a guy named Andrew Alper, who was kind of he was the chief of the Economic Development Corporation. There were three guys who were really important in development and economic development policy, which is really what I looked at. And that's Bloomberg, obviously, Dan Doktoroff, and Andrew Alper. I couldn't interview Doktoroff or Bloomberg, but I did interview Alper. And I talked to a lot of the people around those folks, which is one of the things that was important in the book, because I argue it's not just about the Bloomberg administration, is not just about Bloomberg, but about all these sort of upper level white collar professionals and corporate elites who came into the administration. I argue it was a class project, the development of this corporate approach to the city. And it wasn't, so it's not just about Bloomberg, it's about this larger social group kind of stepping forward and saying we should be running the city because of our, you know, private sector experience and our expertise. It was interesting talking to, you know, all the, you know, people in their 20s and early 30s who had been working in management consulting or investment banking and gave up really lucrative careers to move into City Hall. And they all, you know, almost without exception, said they wouldn't have done it except for Bloomberg and Doktoroff and the nature of the administration. So that's the argument of the book, that it's a larger process that really goes back a few decades about how New York City's sort of white collar elite has really sort of come to the fore in terms of politics. And that's what the Bloomberg administration, at least its early years, was about.
So in your book, are you arguing that they forget about the social aspects of the city to put forth their business ideas and stuff like that in managing the city? And is that the disconnect that happens at that point? Or
yeah, that's about right. I mean, I think that what I argue is that the corporate approach to politics and the sort of rejection that politics is something worthwhile or that has a place in governance of the city is a problem because, you know, the idea is that corporations, they have a bottom line, they have sort of a very top-down structure. Mm-hmm. CEOs want to be judged on results, not on process. And my argument is this works okay in some areas of urban governance, but in the ones that I looked at, which had to do with like the West Side Stadium and development on the West Side, you know, these are really contentious and controversial issues where there's not necessarily one right way to do things. It depends on, you know, some people are going to win, some people are going to lose. Some people's idea about what the city should be is going to prevail and others won't. And so there's no right answer. And in that kind of situation, this corporate approach doesn't work very well.
I was going to say, because a guy like Bloomberg always has the right answer, I'm sure, in his mind. So that's
exactly. And so then when a bunch of, you know, rabble-rousers from the West Side say you don't have the right answer, that kind of model of governance doesn't work particularly well. And one of the things I argue is over time, Bloomberg became more effective at kind of co-opting and you know, different groups are creating a coalition of support outside of that corporate elite.
I think that Bloomberg came in strictly with a business ideal. And over the years, he's been there a long time now, has now incorporated the political party, the political aspect of
the job. Well, you have to actually succeed in maintaining
your
sanity.
And I think that, you know, he did a generally good job. You know, let's think about the prior mayors. Some have been much more effective. Some have been less effective. Some have been, okay, mediocre. Just before we go on to the next subject, I just want to tell you, I got very close to Bloomberg. I was invited to breakfast at Gracie Mansion, and I had breakfast with Bloomberg and a bunch of other ladies. He invited some small business women business owners for breakfast at Gracie Mansion. It was really fabulous. And I really kind of liked the guy. It was early on in his administration.
Yeah, well, he's a very, you know, in some ways, he's a very compelling figure and, you know, appealing in some ways. I mean, you know, kind of his, the whole sort of, kind of confrontational, you know, CEO mentality can be appealing. And I think a lot of people were glad to see that.
Well, yeah, but after the last guy, Giuliani. Yeah. Right.
And especially, and I mean, I think it's easy to forget, you know, after 9/11, Giuliani was rehabilitated a bit. But before 9/11,
everybody was just. So that's what I want to talk about. Giuliani has his legacy now as 9/11. And that was right before he got booted out. He was finished. And like you said, right before 9/11, we were all kind of disgusted with him. Now, Bloomberg has an opportunity to leave a legacy. You know, he's got how many more years? About two more years left as mayor?
2013.
And, you know, he was good for a while. He pissed a lot of people off. Pissed me off when he ran the third time. Pissed me off a lot. So now he has an opportunity to get on the side with Occupy Wall Street or fight them. And this could be a very important decision in his mayor.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what he's and his administration is struggling with right now is the fact that they know that, you know, this thing is worldwide and that it's viewed positively by a lot of people. So that's on one side. And on the other side, I mean, Bloomberg has been very clear about kind of which side he, you know, stakes his stake on. I mean, he said very early on, after the financial crisis. Well, no, after the financial crisis, you know, when corporate elites were kind of being pilloried in the media, he was like, oh, I feel sorry for these people. They've worked hard and, you know, yeah, they may have destroyed the world economy, but, you know, they're good guys. And so I think, you know, and he continued to appoint them to his administration and the whole Kathy Black fiasco.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think he made it really clear, you know, that his loyalties lay with this group of people. So I think he's conflicted. And I don't think he's going to come out and support Occupy Wall Street. I think it's just his class position and his experience just make it impossible. I think he's trying to figure out a way to negotiate between a way to diffuse them essentially without, you know, handing them, you know, a victory by making people more sympathetic by being more confrontational. And I think that's one of the things he was calculating last week when he didn't clean the park.
Because
it would have been a big, bigger victory.
This is so against his personality to negotiate or compromise.
Well,
this
I think
position.
This is where what he's learned in his tenure, whereas like Giuliani would have just come through with
right.
the cops and been
right.
like,
yeah. bulldozed.
Yeah, and then, you know, that would have just created more and more conflict. I think this is what, as you were saying, this is what he's learned, that he can't just have his way.
But his nature is not to concede to these people.
He's like a type A controlling, and, you know, when you're the CEO, you have your way, that's the way it's supposed to go, and that's how you operate.
Right.
And now
so why,
like,
is he, why is he negotiating and compromising?
Well, I think that the position, you know, I think that his political position has been weakened. I mean, the power of, you know, I think a lot of, you know, financial elites realize, there are some who are quite arrogant and say, you know,
Not
you should be bailing us out, you know, because we are, you know, we've done such great things for the global economy, despite all evidence to the contrary. But I think there are also a lot of people who realize that that kind of, that in a lot of ways, there's a lot of potential that we're now seeing, you know, emerge. Sort of bad feeling expressed towards finance, and they want to figure out a way to diffuse some of that. So I think that, and I think given the, you know, what we were talking about earlier in Europe and what we're seeing in the U.S. now, I think there's a sense that, you know, that the kind of the string of good luck has run out a bit. There's also economic problems facing Wall Street. They're going to start laying people off. There's the potential of another financial crisis. So I think that a lot of people in the financial elite are very worried. There's also, you know, little sign that the economy is going to come back. So I think a lot of people are really worried about the economic and political context. And so something like this comes along, and I think that it really
magnifies
it. It magnifies it, and it makes these folks realize that they need to kind of recalibrate the way they've been responding.
Right. Business as usual might have to change.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I have a thought about this. I, you know, since the majority of the country now believes in this occupation around the country, to me, it makes perfect sense for the politicians to embrace this movement. They would get the popular vote.
But they can't.
Why can't they?
Because the lobbyists give them the money to run their campaigns.
Yeah.
That's where they get the money from.
I understand. And Julian said the same thing prior to the show. We were chatting about this. But what wins elections? Yes, you need money to win elections, but you need votes. More votes put you into
Don't vote.
But people will vote. People have voted. They've turned out better, more, stronger.
Not last election. And people,
with Obama, they turned out in droves. No, so, you know, I think that, you know, since the majority is behind this, I don't see why a politician wouldn't just jump on board and ride this wave.
I think there'll be some who do that. And I also think that what something like Occupy Wall Street does and what the Tea Party did before is it sort of changes the terms of the conversation. I mean, especially given, you know, how the media has become much more decentralized. Mm-hmm. So people are, you know, following this on Twitter and Facebook and all the rest of it, and outside of the you know, sort of channels of Fox News and, you know, CNN and so on. So I think that this is changing kind of what the limits of the discourse are. Mm-hmm. So now things that people didn't talk about 6 months ago and possible policies that people didn't talk about 6 months ago are on the table.
Good. That's what this is all about.
It's just about getting out there and changing people's ideas and opening their eyes.
Well, bringing up the anger finally to the surface and making these politicians represent their constituents instead of their financial supporters.
Well, if it actually comes to fruition, that would be great. But at this point, like, unless we see results in this next election, it's going to be harder. Unless congressmen are like kicked out of office for not backing this movement. And they're still getting the money from these lobbyists for the financial sectors and all these other big corporations and stuff. There will be little or no effect, I think, in government unless something actually happens.
Well, we have a year, but go ahead, Julian. Yeah,
that's just the president. Every year there's elections for congressmen.
No, but there's very very little going on this November, so it's really next year.
I mean, I think the other thing we have to remember is, you know, if you look at all these social movements that I referred to earlier, that, you know, changed American society, they work out over long periods
That's
of
right.
time. So, you know, right now it seems very exciting and things mm-hmm. seem very open. 3 months ago, they didn't. You That's know, right. and in 2 months, you know, this thing may dwindle out. But what it's channeling is very real, so it's going to continue coming back.
And it could be in another form and another
space.
But I think
at this point, things are sped up so much more, though, at this point. Like,
well, with
like,
the real time.
Look at Egypt, how it took, 2 weeks
That's
to topple
right.
a
That's
country.
Right.
Like,
That's right.
The fact that this has gone on over a month
right.
and that this
That's
it's still
big.
Growing
That's big.
And the media and the social media more and like people interacting on blogs and
But
talking
he's
about
right
that way.
Though. You can't
of
say
course,
that this is going to affect change.
Which
it
is why
be.
I said November's election will set a precedent for next year. If there is change this year, then people will hold on to it more, I think, and see that mm-hmm. this can affect change.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep going with this okay. and actually make a change in the presidential and major Senate elections right. in Congress next year.
Yeah.
I think that's my real Like well, November is going to be a big thing.
Well, let's keep supporting it then. Let's
of
keep
course.
Doing what we're doing, okay? All right, we're going to say goodbye this week. I want to thank you, Julian, for coming on.
No, thanks for having me.
Don't forget his book. It's about Mayor Bloomberg. Tell us the name again.
Bloomberg's New York Class and Governance in the Luxury City.
And they can get it online?
You can get it online. You can get it at your local independent bookstore. You can order it if they don't have it.
Okay. Barnes & Noble doesn't have it. We don't like big box stores.
They have it. But
oh, yeah, they have it, too.
You can look elsewhere.
Okay. Thanks again. We'll talk to you guys next week. Take care.
Hey.
As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market.